You're listening to the FQXI podcast. But oh, if we call the whole thing off, then we won't be able to discuss the next big news item of July, as NASA announced a new haul of planets orbiting other star systems, as spotted by the Kepler telescope, including Kepler-452b, the most Earth-like planet we have yet discovered.
That's right. Kepler-452b lies 1,400 light-years from Earth in the constellation of Cygnus in our galaxy. Due to its size and age, it could be a rocky planet with a thick atmosphere and active volcanoes, although that's speculation based on modeling rather than known facts. Writing for Space.com and Scientific American, Mike Wall notes that Earth's twin is 60% wider and about five times more massive, so it's likely that gravity on its surface will be twice as strong as here on Earth. And it orbits its star at a similar distance to Earth's orbit around the Sun. A year on Kepler-452b lasts 385 days, which I think means that you get 20 days extra holiday time there.
Oh, I wish. That also means that it lies the right distance from its star, which is 1.5 billion years older than our Sun, to allow liquid water to exist on the surface. And in turn, that means it could host life.
So, how do we find out if there are aliens there, or indeed anywhere out there?
That's exactly what I asked Frank Drake, one of the pioneers of modern SETI, which stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Drake was speaking to me in the run-up to the launch of a new $100 million project called Breakthrough Listen to scan the skies for alien communications. The 10-year project is funded by Russian billionaire and trained physicist Yuri Milner and also involves FQXI advisor Martin Rees of Cambridge University. It will use two radio telescopes at Green Bank in West Virginia and the Parkes Observatory in Australia and an optical telescope at the Lick Observatory in California to survey the nearest million stars in the Milky Way and also nearby galaxies. Drake, Milner, Rees, Stephen Hawking, and a host of other famous names have also just signed an open letter calling for renewed interest in SETI. Drake carried out the first SETI experiment in 1960 at the Green Bank Telescope, and a year later, at the first ever SETI conference, he came up with an equation to calculate the likelihood that alien civilizations exist. The Drake equation includes many unknown parameters, such as the kinds of numbers that the Kepler mission is homing in on about planets able to host life. We discussed the potential impact of Breakthrough Listen and its search strategy. But first, I asked Drake what drove him to continue with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence for more than 50 years, given how poorly funded it has been in the past and its failure to have found any signals so far.
Well, that's a good question, and it's often asked, and not just in the context of low money, but the fact that we've already searched for 50 years without finding anything. Mm. And they say, oh, haven't you really shown there's nothing there to be found? And the answer to that question is we've hardly begun, because we have so many stars and so many frequency channels that are untouched. But anyway, the answer to both of those versions of the question, you know, why do you keep doing this, is that we, once you think about SETI and the impact of a discovery, you are very strongly hit with the thought that the results of the discovery will be momentous. Acquisition of knowledge of another civilization, knowledge of what they are like, what they have accomplished. You realize they will likely be much older than we are, more experienced, with more knowledge and technology from which we could learn, and that the benefits of such a discovery are just almost beyond belief. And so this is what keeps people motivated, even though on any given day the chances of them actually making the discovery are very, very small.
How did you become interested in the first place?
Oh, I got interested when I was about 8 years old. And my father told me one day there were other worlds in space. And to an 8-year-old kid, that meant other Earths, places just like where I lived and people like me and houses like where I lived and all of that. And that really got my interest and have been interested ever since. And I keep coming back to that thought, what are these other places like? And of course, the more we know, the more I realize that it's going to be a lot more than just a place like Earth. It's going to be something very different and probably far more advanced.
You know, given that statement you've just made, that it probably won't be like, you know, Earth Mark 2, when you then think about how to set up a search, you know, given that it's a more advanced civilization, they could have more advanced technology, things that we can't even imagine, you know, tell me a little bit about the history of how you kind of all sat down and thought, well, what's the best way to approach this? Because this obviously goes back many decades. Of what strategy do you employ?
It goes back 50 years, and there's always this question of a strategy, and always with the concern that we are a very primitive civilization. We are beginners. In our thinking, we have normally been very conservative. We realize there's probably technologies out there beyond our wildest dreams, but we don't know what they are. And so we try to design our searches to detect forms of technology which we know exist, which means our own, because that's the only ones we know exist. How would we find that technology? So we think about using spacecraft and radio waves and light waves and gravity waves and neutrino beams and all sorts of things. When you do that, you recognize very quickly that the use of spacecraft to go to other worlds is very challenging and very expensive. And it's slow. There's no way you can really go fast somewhere. You can go a few tenths the speed of light, and that's as fast as you can go, or you will certainly be destroyed in a collision with a rock or something. When you go through all that thought over and over, you always end up thinking that the best way is to capture their radio signals or perhaps light transmissions, if they use that to transmit information. But even with the radio, possible frequencies and wavelengths are quite extensive. And so we usually try to use some logic to pick frequency bands which are more likely to be used by the extraterrestrials. And here the universe has given us some help, because there are sources of static radio noise in the universe which are present on all frequencies. And they become quite strong at some frequencies and are really very difficult to use as a communication channel, because the noise drowns out the communication. The lower frequencies, which are the frequencies we associate with, say, FM radio, there's a great deal of noise from galactic cosmic rays. When you go to very high frequencies, that is to the infrared and light, there's a source of noise because electromagnetic radiation comes in the form of photons and, you know, particles, actually. And these rain down on you. And so if you really have a very sensitive receiver when you're receiving, say, a light beam, each photon would make a splash or a sound in your radio receiver. It would sound like the pitter-patter of rain on the roof.
Uh-huh.
And that's noise. And light photons, the energy in light photons is proportional to their frequency. So the noise gets louder and louder the higher you go in frequency. It's an interesting thought that every civilization will know this. It's not hard to know these things. But in between, there's what we call a window. And we think all civilizations know this, and they will exploit this range of frequencies, just for the reasons that you can do it with least expense and difficulty and with better reliability. We call this the water hole, by the way, because the primary spectral lines of H and OH are in this frequency band. We think that's kind of nice because we are water-based life. So there's a whole bunch of poetic sort of coincidence here. So we call this the water hole, and most of our searches over the last 50 years have been in the water hole. Now, as to where to search at the present time, we have so little information on stars with planets, that just about every star is fair game. What we've learned is about one in every five stars has a planet in the habitable zone. So basically, we just need to point where the stars are and listen in the water hole, and then search the whole spectral range and the whole sky. And that's a big, big order.
It's big, yes, exactly. Given the funding that URI is giving and this kind of 10-year time frame, and then also given how big the universe is, do you think we'll see something within 10 years?
Yeah, well, that's a question that almost always gets asked, and I dread it. There's no good answer to it, because there's several difficulties with searching the whole sky. One is, what does the bandwidth of the signal you assume? The narrower the bandwidth, the more easily the signal is detected. Are we looking for television signals? Are we looking for telemetry like that from a spacecraft? And this means there are many options when you set up your equipment. What bandwidth do you use? And you probably should try a large range. There's also another question, which is, do they transmit in your direction all the time? If you put your place in another civilization which is trying to communicate with people like us, and we hope that's the case, we'd like them for them to be helping us, which raises a whole another interesting question, which is there altruism in the universe? Do the others do things for the primitives like us just to be good neighbors? But if that's the case, they're presented with a challenge, because they don't know where the civilizations are, probably. And so they don't know exactly which stars to transmit to. So what do you do? You can't transmit in all directions at once, because then the signal in any given direction is very weak. You probably use a narrow beam, which makes the signal strong. But if you send a narrow beam, you can only send it to a few stars at a time, and maybe those aren't the right ones. So how do you cope with this? Well, you probably scan around the sky. You send the signal into one star after another, over and over.
Yeah.
And now that creates the problem that we may look at the right star on the right frequency, but at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And so it's just not possible to predict how long it will take, because we don't know how the extraterrestrials are playing the game.
Can I ask you, you mentioned this, this question about whether the other civilizations, whether there's altruism out there. And of course, people also wonder whether, alien civilizations might have bad intentions towards us. But what's your personal view on that?
Now, I have a strong personal view on that, and I think that there's no threat to us. For two reasons. One is, actually send vehicles or anything from one star to another is extremely energy consuming. If we make the most optimistic guesses we can make about how close are the nearest civilizations, they're probably at least 100 light years away. So if you're going to go to a place 100 light years away, at the speed of light, it would take you 100 years, but you can't do that. That's forbidden by the laws of physics. If you look at a speed that is reasonable, that you might approach with nuclear fusion rockets, which we don't have, but which are hypothetically possible, the fastest you can go is about 15% the speed of light. Any faster than that, and you're subject to devastating destruction if you encounter a thing even the size of a pebble. It releases as much energy as a nuclear bomb. So if you go, let's say, 10th the speed of light, it takes you 1,000 years to go 100 light years. Now, that's very challenging. It's hard to believe you would send small groups of people that are sort of live and reproduce and do all that for 1,000 years. It would not be worth it. There's no benefit you would get at the other end that would justify something of that magnitude. The cost also, if you take very simple physics and calculate the amount of energy required to send a spacecraft that might, say, carry 30 people, it's like a small airliner, at a 10th the speed of light, It takes, just to get it up to that speed, about as much power is produced by all the electrical plants of Earth in 100 years.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous, it's a totally ridiculous amount. So, in a way, the laws of physics and the great distance between the stars are protecting us from attack. If you want to benefit from what the other civilization has, you learn from them how to build things. You don't transport things.
I have to ask you about the Drake equation and how you came up with it, and did you anticipate, you know, how important it would become and how identified it would become with SETI?
Well, I wish there were a story like the story of Sir Isaac Newton and the apple. But there's no such story that goes with that. After I did the first search in 1960, the National Academy of Sciences in the States wanted to have a small conference on this whole subject because it did get a lot of publicity at the time. And they asked me to organize it. So I organized it, and I invited everybody in the world that I knew of that was interested in the subject, all 12 of them. So they all showed up, or they were all on their way. And I realized, well, we've got to have an agenda. You can't just get everybody in a room and start talking. So I sat down and I thought, well, what do we need to talk about? I thought, what matters? And what matters are the seven factors that are in the equation. So I wrote them all down, and I thought, well, that's each one will be the topic for a session. You know, one rate of star formation will be the morning session, and fraction of stars of the planets will be the afternoon session. So that was how I arranged the agenda. And as I was doing it, I realized if you multiplied all these things together, you got the number of technical civilizations in the universe. So that's how I started the meeting. I just wrote the equation down and said, this is an equation which tells us how many places there are out there to find, and this is what we need to know, these seven things. And that's how it came about. And the interesting thing is it hasn't changed in 50 years. A lot of people have wanted to add funny little factors for politicians and stuff like that. So it sort of stood in its original form to this day. And it also turns out to be a useful educational aid, because even mathematically challenged students find it understandable and possible to work with, because it's just a simple product and there's nothing in the denominator. Students just love that part of it.
Well, over the past 50 years, you know, there has been a lot of progress, and actually very recent progress, in coming up with some of these parameters that you outlined. I mean, you know, and just sort of the search for planets and looking for habitable planets and that sort of thing. Did you anticipate that we would be able to actually get some estimate on the numbers within this time frame?
Well, I knew that some of them are not knowable till we found another civilization. But some of them I knew we were on our way to finding out about, like the typical number of planets in the habitable zone, the number of planets in a planetary system. I thought the chemists would do a much better, more complete job of understanding the chemical origins of life. But there were some things I thought were going to remain unknown until we've actually detected another civilization. And the one of those which matters the most is the very last factor, which is the length of time a civilization remains detectable. I don't think we can use our own history as a reliable guide in guessing at.
Why not? Just because we could live a lot longer than we can imagine, or because...
It depends on whether we're altruistic, among other things. Do we send messages intentionally? That would change everything. And also, just what inventions we come up with that make ourselves visible. At the present time, we are visible by our very strong radio transmissions. But we are presently sort of moving away from those to direct-to-Earth satellite transmissions and cable television. The Earth is not yet going quiet, but it's on the verge of going quiet, because the main sign of our existence, which is our over-the-air television transmissions, are in a situation where they may be closed out in the near future. Similarly, our military radars, which were one of our strongest signs of our existence, have become less powerful because they can just be built more cleverly. So Earth shows signs of becoming less detectable. On the other hand, there are things that could make us more detectable if we put solar power stations in space, transmitting power to Earth. If we colonize space and have data links between our colonies, that would make us visible. So it's really a very open question, I think, as to how long, typically, let alone us, a civilization remains detectable.
This is sort of a sociological question, or sociology of science, perhaps. But you kind of joked about, you know, at the start of SETI, there were not that many people who perhaps were really interested in it. And over the years, because of the kinds of ups and downs in funding, you know, it's not been the sort of thing that perhaps, you know, people who actually are interested in it probably wouldn't think of making a career out of it.
That's right.
Now you've got this injection of cash. Do you think that could change things?
It will change things. There are many people who would like to do SETI, but there are two obstacles. One, they've known that the funding support is very low. And the second thing is, it's not a good career path for a young scientist because you produce almost no results. Without results, it's hard to get jobs and pay raises. I know how to get around this, which we have practiced in the past, and that is that when you take someone to do a SETI program, you tell them you're not going to do just this. You've got to do roughly half your time on something in conventional astronomy, studying stars and galaxies and such, that will produce real results that can give you a record of success. And it turns out that that's necessary. It's also, when you actually do it, necessary because actually doing SETI can be very boring. You look at records that have nothing but noise on them hour after hour, and after a few days, that gets pretty boring. You have to be highly motivated to do SETI.
Do you think that now that you've got so much telescope time, and these are still very good instruments, you know, is there a chance that you will make discoveries that are nothing to do with SETI, but actually are very interesting astronomical discoveries?
I think we will. There are two things we will almost certainly discover, and that is a lot more pulsars. They're best discovered and studied with large single dishes like the ones we're going to be using. And in fact, that's about all the Parkes telescope works on now. And they're very interesting objects, still not well understood at all. And the other thing is, we're going to be searching the whole water hole. And we're going to be looking at many frequency bands that have never been looked at with a radio telescope. And we will probably detect some molecular spectral lines and detect new molecules in the universe. Also, there's this latest phenomenon called the fast radio bursts, which are very bright radio bursts that happen once in a while, and we don't know where they come from or what that's all about. Those will show up in our data, too. So there should be some interesting regular astronomical discoveries along the way.
What are you looking forward to most now, I guess? What are the sort of the next steps?
There is already a loosely defined plan which calls for us to do a targeted search of stars where we know there are planets in the habitable zone, as a result of the radial velocity studies in the Kepler project, and then search the entire Milky Way. That's going to take a lot of time. And then a third project, which is a very speculative one, is to search nearby galaxies for signals. Now, the reason you might do that, you might think, oh, that's crazy, that's very far away, and it is. The signals from another galaxy will typically be a million times fainter than signals from nearby stars in our own galaxy. So for this to succeed, it requires there to be sort of a super civilization in another galaxy. But the good side is that you can search a whole galaxy in almost no time. You can look at 100 billion stars in one night.
Oh, wow. You mentioned that it can be quite boring having to search through all of this noise. You're talking now about, you know, having so much telescope time and so much potential data coming in. Are you prepared just for the data processing and just for, you know, having to go through this vast amount of data that's going to come in?
No, we have pretty good data processing computer algorithms and programs that have been developed over the years for the searches which are going on right now. But they're not as comprehensive as we'd like. They don't search for every possible kind of signal. Both my worries but also hopes is that perhaps the extraterrestrials are sending us holograms. Holograms, if we could recognize it as such, we know how to decode them. We don't need to know a language or anything. You just record the hologram in the right way and show a laser on it, and there will be a 3D image of the extraterrestrial standing there looking at you. But a hologram, if you've ever seen one, which very few people have, it looks like noise.
Yes, no, I've made a hologram, and so I do. I know what you're talking about. So I had one displayed, I think, in my room, and people used to come and look at it and say, "What is that? It's horrible."
Yeah, you know? That's right. Well, okay, then you're one of the few people who understand what I just was talking about. I look at the screen. Could this be a hologram? What we need most right now are computer programmers to deal with the signal types, as I was just talking about. But also we need people just to be at the telescopes. One of the things about SETI, which is very costly, is that you really need to have people there all the time, so that if you get a candidate signal, you can immediately take action to identify it and determine whether it's really extraterrestrial or more likely radio interference. And as a result, there's a whole lot of candidate signals that have been captured and have never been identified as to whether they are extraterrestrial or not.
Right, I see, because I guess if you find that out afterwards at a later time, you can't then go back and, or you can try to train your telescope in the same place, but it might have stopped or...
That's right, and that's what's happened at least 100 times. They've gotten very good candidate signals, haven't discovered it in the data till a month later, typically. They go back, point the telescope, same frequency, and there's nothing there.
Right. And, you know, was it gratifying to you? I know that, you know, you've got this open letter and that a lot of people have been showing support from all kinds of areas in science. Was that particularly gratifying to you to see that people are really coming together behind this?
Oh, it's very good. And what Yuri's doing is just unbelievable. When I did the first search in 1960, our total budget for the project was $2,000 US. Now we got $100 million. That's real progress. That's something I never would have believed possible. Not then, and even yesterday almost.
Thank you to Frank Drake for chatting with Zia. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, there's a link to Zia's story about Breakthrough Listen for Nature, plus a link to our podcast interview from 2013 with alien hunter Sarah Seeger.